Hello all, this is Daron Orenstein of Best Saxophone Website Ever and InfiniteMusician.com, and right now I wanted to present an interview I recently did with the great saxophonist, composer, recording artist, and educator Remy LaBeouf. And to give a bit of a background on Remy for those of you who don't know his work, besides playing and collaborating with the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra and Wynton Marsalis, Lewis Cole and David Binney, to name just a few, he also leads, with his brother Pascal, a Grammy-nominated ensemble called the LaBeouf Brothers. As a composer, he's been commissioned to write for SF Jazz, National Foundation for the Advancement in the Arts, and the American Composers Forum, just naming a few here. And on top of all of that, he currently teaches at the Manhattan School of Music and University of South Florida. So what brings Remy and myself together today is his recent collection of etudes for solo saxophone titled Vignettes, which I've been lucky enough to publish on InfiniteMusician.com as an exclusive video masterclass edition, where in addition to the sheet music, there's also over 40 minutes of amazing video instruction along with demonstrations of Remy playing through some of the pieces. So with all of that said, here's my interview with Remy. I hope you enjoy it.
All right, everyone. So here is Remy right now. So Remy, I wanted to welcome you and thanks for taking the time to chat with me today.
Happy to be here.
Yeah. So, you know, I wanted to dive in by asking you about your really diverse set of musical skills and namely your compositional skills, which are, for anyone who's heard your music, it goes way outside the typical realm of like a jazz saxophonist writing some tunes. So I'm going to play a quick selection of your music just to give folks who aren't familiar with your music a sense of what we're talking about now. So they'll be right back. Okay, so, you know, my question is really, how did you develop the ability to hear and compose music like this, which is, seems to be very steeped in, like, a lot of traditions that a lot of sax players aren't that steeped in, like, you know, contemporary classical music, minimalism, like Steve Reich, sure. Or whatever. I don't want to butcher, what your influences are, but, how did you develop that ability?
I mean, there's no magic answer. I just listened to a lot of that music and have had opportunities to perform some of that music. So growing up, I played oboe since I was 10. So I got to play in the youth orchestra in my hometown in Santa Cruz, California. I also was a boy soprano and sang in like operas with an opera company, you know, before my voice changed, and, you know, performed a lot of Leonard Bernstein's music and Ben Britten's music. And so I kind of, like, without even realizing it, I had these favorite composers that were just kind of becoming a part of me as I was growing up. And in addition to that, you know, I was playing saxophone with my twin brother once a week at the farmer's market for tips, just playing, like, Duke Ellington classics and jazz standards. And as, you know, I got more serious about music, I started developing those things. And even as I got deeper into music in the academic realm, like as I was a student at Manhattan School of Music, I would take classes in 20th century theory or Stravinsky's music, in addition to being, you know, a jazz major and, you know, studying rhythmic analysis and like all this whatever classes that I had to take for my jazz major. So I was just lucky to be in an environment that, you know, offered me those, you know, opportunities. And also, I think even in a less like direct like learning way, I just like really enjoyed listening to all this different kinds of all this different music. And I had friends who, you know, played other kinds of music. I didn't just hang out with jazz musicians. I didn't just hang out with musicians, you know. I had friends who were in different, you know, fields, and those ideas kind of influenced me. So I'd say that goes even beyond music, you know.
And how did you divide your time up, like between practicing the horn and composing? Is it,
what was the
balance? Because the composer, like I said, compositionally, what I'm hearing from you is far beyond like typical jazz saxophonist. So what was the breakdown?
Yeah, I mean, and it's not even just those two things. I mean, you throw into that, you know, also like, you know, applying for things or, you know, spending time with my friends and family or, you know, booking a tour and, you know, just so many things to take up one's time. But I need to play saxophone a little bit every day. It's like brushing my teeth, you know, and it's a part of like being a healthy person for me, even if it's just a little bit. Composing, I sometimes go through phases, but I usually compose a little bit every day too. They're both just a part of who I am and a part of what art and expression and music is to me. So one of the great things about composing the vignettes was I could bring together my saxophone practice with my composition. And that's why it was such a relief writing them. The pandemic had hit just after I started working on the vignettes. And they kind of carried me through the like most difficult, challenging times. And I could just practice in my rehearsal space in a basement somewhere in Brooklyn into the wee hours of the morning. And I could just like write these very technically challenging pieces while writing them and while learning them. I'm like also developing my technique as a saxophonist. So it was a really fun process for me. So with the vignettes, I didn't have to separate them. But normally I'll spend time composing at the piano and, you know, time practicing on the saxophone. And I just have to make time for each one. So saxophone has to be consistent, though. If I miss a day or a week of composing, like, I'm not going to, like, lose my ability to compose.
Yeah.
Whereas saxophone, I, like, don't practice a day and I, like, notice it immediately.
Yeah, it's a lot more of the, involves a lot more of the muscle memory type of stuff. That
for sure,
probably
yeah.
Easier to slip away. And so going into vignettes and performing them, do you have any tips or guidance for making a compelling performance with just a solo saxophone? Because these aren't like etudes with piano accompaniment. These are meant to be performed completely solo. So
I'd say yeah, I mean, you kind of have to get in my head a little bit. I talk about in the series that, you know, we created together, about having like two voices at once. So like, I had to spell out the harmony. So you have generally the low notes, you know, a bass player would kind of, you know, dictate the foundation that the melody is based on top of. So in writing for a solo voice, I ended up having a lot of large intervals and big leaps and like extreme register stuff. So I'd have like a lot of low register stuff to kind of define whatever's above it. So that was one of the challenges, but also one of the fun things about the pieces. Mm-hmm. So, but that's definitely an aspect of solo saxophone playing or any solo instrument, you know, that's a one voice, like Bach's cello suites, for example. I mean, I guess he's got double stops in there, but like, Bach does a really great job of like defining things with the low register while, you know, having beautiful melodies in the upper register and kind of bringing them together in beautiful ways and having counterpoint with one voice. And it's just very interesting. It was a fun process.
And I would imagine that as a jazz improviser, being able to think of like being a one-man band, like hitting, you know, counterpoint all within your own perhaps improvised single note melody, you know, that you might be playing while improvising with a small group. It seems like this would have a lot of benefits, being able to do this kind of a solo performance, being able to hear music as a solo saxophone. That was a complete word salad, but...
No, I get what you're saying. I think the benefits for jazz musicians are, I mean, first of all, a lot of the vocabulary that I use, you know, if you practice a lot of bebop, you have a lot of bebop vocabulary. Mm-hmm. And I kind of, you know, I have that in me, but these vignettes aren't really about like bebop vocabulary. I don't think there's any in there at all, but it's still very jazzy. You know, there are certain shapes and colors and things that really apply well to a modern jazz player, you know, and if for somebody who likes the kind of the like melodic harmonic devices that I'm using in my solos in a jazz context, all that stuff is like really like the vignettes are really soaked in those ideas and those colors and those things. Like, it's really very personal and like it's very much my sound in there. And I feel like a lot of my writing, whether for jazz or for whatever, you know, it just kind of reflects me. You know, so like that's why I think that these pieces work really well for classical players and jazz players alike, because it's not about me trying to uphold a tradition. It's just me trying to be myself and all the things that I am.
Yeah, cool. Definitely. Yeah, it's definitely the impression I get listening through them.
And technique-wise too, like to answer the other part of your question, sorry. In terms of like just having a better technique on the saxophone, like jazz players can definitely get that from in order to play beautifully across these ranges, you sort of have to force yourself to have good technique. So, yeah.
Yeah, the stuff that doesn't fall under the fingers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are pretty challenging pieces, and I was wondering, especially, you know, being that you do a lot of teaching, how would you recommend someone break down a challenging piece of music, like any of the vignettes, when you're looking at the music, at the, you know, at the sheet music, and are like, oh my God, I don't even know where to begin with this stuff. How do you break it down to make it more manageable?
Great question. Whenever I practice a piece like this, I've got my metronome, and I will work on it really slowly with the metronome, basically as slow as it has to be in order to play it. You know, I've got the you know, this little guy right here, you know, so it's got the little wheel, the spinning wheel, you know, and so I use those kind of intervals between different, you know, like 100 to 104 to 108, you know, like. So what I'll do is I'll just, you know, start something very slow, and then I'll just bring it up a notch or two, and then bring it up another notch or two. I mean, it's not rocket science, but like it really makes a difference. So like over the period of like 2 days, I will learn a vignette, you know, basically by doing just that, and then I'll whip it into really good shape, and then I won't need the metronome anymore. But the metronome kind of it allows me to record my progress, you know. Aldous Huxley, one of my favorite writers, he says, progress can never be experienced, only recorded. In one of his books, Eyeless in Gaza. It's something like that. I think that's a paraphrase. But like, but it's so true. Like, if you want to observe yourself getting better, you can't really do that easily. But the metronome is something that helps us measure our progress and control the speed at which we progress. And for most players, it's something that keeps us patient. You know, I think our, you know, tendency is to want to do it fast right away, and we end up getting in our own way. So it's really it can be a very zen, enjoyable experience. And if you just have more time to learn it, and you know, make up the distance between those big intervals, or if it's a fast passage, you just have more time to think about all the little details. You can think more about emotion. You can think more about dynamics. You can think more about where you're going to breathe or take that circular breath or whatever. So that's really important part of the process of learning for me.
And would you say, especially for a student who might really struggle, with whether it's one of your vignettes or another challenging piece of music, mm-hmm. or an etude, do you think it's better to spend as much time as necessary to get like a specific passage or even a specific group of measures, sounding good? Or do you, as opposed to just kind of getting through the piece and accepting that it's not going to be perfect, but just
Oh, yeah. If I have a particular spot that's giving me trouble, I will loop that spot several times until I get it more comfortable. And the goal is to play it all the way through. But sometimes in order to get there, I might have to loop a certain spot. Or maybe if I let it sit for a couple days and I come back to it and then this one spot's giving me trouble, I will kind of iron that out. And it's just like being a bodybuilder or something. You have to do reps. You're not going to do 700 push-ups in one day and be ripped. You're going to have to do a little bit or brushing your teeth again, for that example. I'm not going to brush my teeth a whole bunch one day and then I'm going to be good for the rest of the week. Saxophone maintenance is like this, and learning something is like that kind of a process. So, I'll iron it out.
Yeah. And, there's definitely a good amount of altissimo in the pieces. And I know in the video you have, a little video in the video portion of our online presentation of vignettes, you have a section on altissimo. But I was wondering, as it pertains to the pieces, but in a general sense, how did you develop your ability to get around the horn so quickly in that altissimo register?
I mean, it was a process over time. I think that most students, when they're learning about things like altissimo or just in general, they want to be spoon-fed some golden miracle that's just going to make everything work for them. And that's just not how it is. You have to care and over a long period of time and just want to do it, or you'd be hearing things up there, And what I did was I would practice, exercises, I'd practice all my intervals and major seconds and minor thirds and major thirds and perfect four, all the way up to a major seventh, for example. And I would do that up to the highest note at a given time. So for a student who's just starting to work on this, I'd do that up to an F on whatever saxophone it is. And then I'd increase it to an F sharp after a while, and I'd increase it to a G, and then a G sharp, and then an A, and then a B flat. And then pretty soon I'm doing all of my fast technical exercises up to altissimo D, or now I'm trying to expand more into D sharp, E, F. And that's where I'm at now. It's still a process. I never arrived. I'm still trying to get higher and higher, trying to catch up with Ben Wendell or, Lenny Pickett or whatever. It's fun. As long as your roommates forgive you for practicing high that often.
Yeah. That and the overtones.
Yes, you do have to practice a lot of overtones. You have to practice flexibility between registers, which is actually very similar to overtones, and that's something that the vignettes give you. But you have to not be looking for shortcuts, basically, and be willing to just put in the time. And that's the magic.
Yeah.
If there's no magic, you just do it.
Yeah, and what I meant, the overtones, I'm trying to think what's more of a pain to listen to for your roommate or family members, the overtones or the altissimo notes. They're both sound pretty nasty when you're just...
they're a similar thing to practice in a way.
Yeah.
You can get almost any altissimo note just from changing your throat, even without your fingers going down on any particular finger. Everyone's what's the fingering for this? And it's not about the fingerings. It's about how you voice your throat.
Yeah.
Mostly, and you have to be able to hear what you're playing in order to hit that note. So you have to be able to hear the note in order to get it for altissimo stuff, I think.
Yeah, it's a very subtle thing. It's hard to spell out to someone exactly, move this, these are muscles that are, that operate seemingly unconsciously all the time.
I mean, it's a lot like singing, though.
That's true,
And even when I'm speaking to you now, my voice has like a natural up and down to it, you know? Mm-hmm. Or if I run out of breath, my voice gets, you know, constricts. And if I run out of breath on saxophone, my voice constricts and I go sharp. And same way the pitch goes up right now when I'm talking to you or whatever, you know, like, it's, we're more familiar with the instrument than we know.
Yeah. And I know we're running out of time here.
It's okay. We've got a couple more minutes.
Okay, cool. Yeah, one thing I was curious about is you've played in a pretty diverse array of musical settings, you know, like what you do with, your brother, the LaBeouf brothers is mm-hmm. totally different than, you know, I understand, and I haven't been able to find a recording, I looked, but I understand you played with Knower, which people don't know about them, is like a very hard-driving electronica fusion crazy music band. How do you adapt to those different kinds of playing situations?
Oh, okay. Well, Knower, we worked with them on a remix project. We like created a mashup with them. Okay. But I know Lewis Cole, the drummer from Knower and from his own stuff, you know. He played some gigs with me when I was when I would go to LA, you know, we'd play a little bit together and we actually started a little band at one point when I was there for about a year and a half, and it's just nothing. We never ended up doing anything more than a couple gigs, but it was super fun. He's just a fun guy to be around and play with, and but yeah, in terms of adapting to other styles, I mean, I listen to other styles as well, and you know, there are moments where I think over time, like when I was a student, I was like, okay, I've got this kind of electronic version of myself, and then I've got this classical version of myself, and I've got this jazz version of myself. And it was always like a challenge to kind of like, what brand am I? Like, who am I? Because I'm like three different people. And I feel like over the course of my career, you know, all of those flavors have kind of like distilled into something together. They are not distilled, but they blended into each other a little bit more. And I think like something like Vignettes, it's like a good culmination of like classical, jazz, and like even pop stuff. Like pop, I say in a very general way, you know. But like, I have an easier time like kind of merging those styles. But I mean, the truth is I just like love a lot of different kinds of music. You know, I love Aphex Twin. I think Aphex Twin is awesome. I love Stravinsky. I love Bjork. I love John Coltrane. I love like Ben Van Gelder, you know, like there's so much interesting music out there. And like, even besides the categories that we've mentioned, you know, like there's like Bulgarian folk music, or I got really into like pedal steel guitar stuff. I was listening to all this like old country ballads, you know, that like, I mean, it's like a joke, like, oh, you know, smooth jazz or country or whatever, you know, there's something to like and respect about like every style of music. Yeah. And and the more you can enjoy music, the more you can enjoy playing other things and expanding who you are. I don't know.
Well, very true. Very true. Well, great. Well, we're just about out of time. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat and share some of your great knowledge with the listeners. So with that, yeah, thanks so much. And I hope people check out the Vignettes program you put together. I think it's really extraordinary. So
yeah. This is a really old copy.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And it's been a pleasure, working with you on this. And I hope it really helps people become who they want to be.
Cool. I like that. Become who they want to be. All right. Well, then. Thanks again, and I'll be talking to you soon.
Cool, thanks.